Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. On Tuesday of this week, our guest, the first part of this hour, wrote on ESPN.com, each year all NFL clubs receive a memo reminding them no bonus or award may directly or indirectly be offered, promised, announced, or paid to a player for his or his team's performance against a particular team or opposing player of or a particular group thereof. No bonuses or awards may be offered or paid for on-field misconduct, for example, personal fouls to or injuries inflicted on opposing players. That the Saints and perhaps the Bills and Redskins violated this clearly stated rule is bad enough. The troubling offense of Sinner's Gate is that the pros, who are looked up to by the young, are setting a terrible example for the high school players and coaches who emulate what they see on Sundays in the NFL. It brings a new low to the National Football League. With football being hammered by scandal after scandal, where is the person of honor who will take a stand to return integrity to the sport? Greg Easterbrook joining us the first part of this hour. Greg is a writer of the Tuesday Morning Quarterback for Page 2 at ESPN. He is a renaissance guy. He's a contributing editor of the Atlantic Monthly, the New Republic, and the Washington Monthly. He lectures and teaches college courses. He's been a staff writer and the national columnist for the Atlantic Monthly, a columnist for NFL.com, an editor of the Washington Monthly, contributing editor to Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, and he has written a number of books, and he likes to add to his resume. He's also been a bartender, a bus driver, and a used car salesman. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Greg on this, which has really rocked the football world. There are many football fans in the state of Wisconsin, of course, with the Green Bay Packers being so prominent, not only in this state, but nationally. And we're going to talk about this sport. And the other part of it, you know, what about these high school players? What about the effects of concussions? Why would there even be such a bounty when these people are making so much money as it is? Well, welcome your phone calls. I would think we'll have a few. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Greg. Thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to be here, Kathleen.
The story that's really upsetting, and you start your piece with this, is this high school game that you went to in your hometown where the high school coach was screaming, "I want someone hurt." Can you tell us about that experience you had?
Well, it was an eye-opener for me. The incident I relate in my piece is certainly not the first football coach to challenge his team to injure the opposition. He won't be the last, but I thought in this case it kind of stepped over the line, and for me it was for a high school coach to say that he wants to see players from the other team injured. And for me it started me down the road of realizing that safety in football, especially in high school football, because high school is where almost all football is played, that safety was a bigger story than people realized. And I started writing about this regularly on ESPN 4 or 5 years ago, before the concussion awareness phase began. Now, the concussion awareness is, I think, a very good development. But I've been crusading on a number of football safety issues, and I'm working on a book right now that has a lengthy section on football safety in it.
There's a lot of talk now about what kind of punishment there should be for the Saints, but there's also talk about how widespread this may be in professional football. How widespread do you think it is? Is it more than the Saints?
Oh, I'm sure that most teams, if not every team, at some point, some coach, either the head coach or assistant, has said, go out there and put those guys on the ground, or I want their quarterback on the ground, that kind of thing. That kind of discussion is surprisingly common in football. Does it really mean that you hope that the opposition will be injured? I don't know. I think where the Saints have, besides the fact that the Saints have clearly just broken clearly stated rules, I think where they went too far was in, according to the NFL's report, their defensive coordinator, Greg Williams, saying that he wanted to see other players carted off injured. That's really different from saying, let's hit their quarterback. That's going too far. And I think it matters most to the example that's set in high school football. NFL players, first of all, there's only 2,000 of them. Almost all of them are very highly paid. They're adults who know that they are assuming a risk. We don't want them to get hurt, but it's hard to feel a great deal of sympathy for an NFL player who makes $5 million a year. There are a million, a little more than a million, high school football players, most of whom will never receive any tangible benefit at all from playing football, except the pleasure of being able to say that I played football in high school. Wisconsin, for example, is a great high school football state. I mean, it's a wonderful place to go and watch a high school football game, but 95-96% of the kids you see playing in Wisconsin are not going to get any kind of recruiting boost to college. They're certainly not going to earn any income from playing football. So if they sustain injuries, that's where the real concern is. Now, if they sustain avoidable injuries or if play is too vicious, leading to harm that could have been avoided, at the very best, they're going to experience physical pain and expense and medical problems and loss of school time. At the worst, they could have debilitating mental or physical conditions that will plague them all through their lives in return for no benefit at all. So that's why I say that high school is where you care the most. College is where you care the second most, because there's the second most number of players in college, and the NFL is where you care the least. But the NFL does set the example for everybody else.
And you write early on in your piece that it takes a beautiful sport and makes it a low and filthy thing.
Yes, yeah, I love football. I played in high school. I played in college. I have an older son who played in college. I go to way too many football games, and I watch way too much football on television. I think it's a wonderful sport. It's almost an artistic sport. It's the most complex sport intellectually. Tactics are more complicated in football than in any other sports, the most challenging sport physically. I love football. But to turn it into an attempt to cause injury makes it filthy. It makes it a low, thuggish, contemptible sort of thing that respectable people should have nothing to do with. And that's one of the very disturbing things about what I call Sinner's Gate, because these saints are definitely not saints; they're sinners. And what doubly drives me crazy not only is attempting to harm your opponent ethically wrong, it's not necessary to have a good football game. I don't know, Kathleen, if you watched the Super Bowl. I was there in Indianapolis for the Giants Patriots game. That was a fantastic football game. It was fascinating from start to finish, and there was no dirty play by either team. You don't need to play dirty to play football well.
Mm-hmm. There's also a change, isn't there, in the size of the players. So you used to have players who may be 250 pounds, and now they're 350 pounds, and there's this huge mass of a human being, more energy, so the possibility of inflicting harm is even greater.
Yes, you have these two countervailing trends, is that players are getting much bigger and much stronger. Your listeners probably know Mel Kiper, the NFL's draft guru. He and I went over data from 30 years ago for a column I did last year, comparing the size and strength increase in football players, and it's very dramatic. Now, at the same time, you also have improved orthopedic medicine, so players are treated better than they used to be treated in the medical sense. But what really jumps out at you is the increase in weight at the high school and college level. 1972, the Miami Dolphins had pro football's only perfect team, probably always be their only perfect team. The average weight of an offensive lineman for the 72 Dolphins was 262 pounds, which seems plenty big enough.
Yes, it does.
There were dozens of high school teams, probably one in Wisconsin, that had bigger offensive lines last year. Texas Tech's offensive line last year averaged 380 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
Excuse me, I said that wrong. 338 pounds, I read the number wrong, but still pretty big. The 1972 Dolphins' perfect team didn't have anybody who weighed more than 300 pounds. Now most good high school football teams have at least several players who weigh more than 300 pounds. And if these players are going on to the NFL, then they'll be well rewarded, but most of them are not. If you force yourself to gain weight to the point of 300 pounds in high school so that you can play on your high school team, yes, it's a lot of fun to play on your high school football team, but you're asking for a lifetime of problems, heart problems, blood pressure, and so on, in return for, you know what, for playing in 20 high school football games?
So when did things change, Greg, and why did things change?
Well, football gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, it's the biggest sport in the biggest and most powerful country in the world, and actually the book that I'm working on, Kathleen, is mainly about that. Why football's impact on American society and why Americans are so crazy about football, which we clearly are, including me. But the more money there is in football, and you've seen the skyrocketing fees that are being paid for NFL and also college games, and in a few cases high school games, in television, the more money you inject into anything, the more pressure there is, the more temptation there is to cut corners, the more desperation there is to win. You think back 30 years ago, there was one college football game on television nationally per week. Last fall, here in the I live in the Washington D.C. area. Washington D.C. We average 34 college football games on television per weekend. So it used to be that only a handful of colleges made significant amounts of money from football. Now, you know, more than 100 in Division I are realizing significant amounts of income from football, and the income is way up. The contracts that the NFL just signed last fall, the new network contracts, NFL is going to average about $12 billion a year just in television revenue starting in 2014. As the money cranks up like this, the pressure cranks up, and the willingness to cheat, mm-hmm. get a piece of that pot, gets worse and worse in college as well as in the pros.
It seems to me as though there must be some... Why isn't there more of an audience outrage? Because when I see somebody getting intentionally hit or hurt, I just cringe. I have to leave the room. It just is physically upsetting to me. Is there an audience for this kind of intentional violence, or are people turned off by it and they're just silent about it?
Well, I think the picture on that is mixed. I can tell you that NFL headquarters, Commissioner Goodell, I think he's right, basically on the right side of this issue, worries that if football keeps getting more violent, and especially people dropping to the ground unconscious with concussions, that it will either turn the public off to football, or it will lead to Congress regulating football in some way, which of course they don't want. I can tell you the sad truth is that there are some people out there who like to see vicious hits and players dropping to the ground unconscious. I mean, in ice hockey, you get a lot of ice hockey fans in Wisconsin. There's a certain percentage of the people in the crowd who want to see a fight break out. I don't think it's the majority. I'll make up a number. I'm going to say that 80% of NFL fans don't want to see injuries. They just want to see a great game. But there is a faction that likes to see people harming each other, and it's a calculation. It's part of the calculation. I think, in general, the safer and the cleaner football is at all three levels, high school, college, and NFL, the longer its popularity will last.
Do you suspect, working on a book on this now, you mentioned the possibility of Congress regulating this sport, do you suspect that things are so bad and we're just at the tip of the iceberg with this and we will see congressional regulation of this game?
I think it's possible. I mean, Congress, I tend to hold a low opinion of modern Congress. I don't know what your listeners think. I think Congress is mainly sold out to interest groups on most issues, and football, clearly, there's a big football interest group. So would Congress be progressive enough to regulate football? It's hard to say. It was almost a century ago was the last time that Washington, via Teddy Roosevelt in the White House, got involved in pressuring football, then college football, to improve its safety standards. I think whether Congress gets involved has a lot to do with what concussion research ultimately shows. You know, I mentioned improving orthopedic medicine, tearing an ACL or an MCL, which used to be a terrible injury, no longer is. If you're properly treated, you're fine 6 or 8 months later. But the concussion research is showing that lifetime harm in many ways can be done not just by big hit concussions where a guy goes flying backwards, but by the slow accumulation of many medium-strength hits in games and also in practice. And that research is all fairly new. I think over the next decade or so, if it shows that football causes long-term mental harm to large numbers of boys, then Congress could get involved, or the courts could get involved. And if football at any level, high school, college, or pros, starts losing litigation over concussion harm, the sport could change very rapidly.
Let's go to phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. Greg Easterbrook is our guest the first part of this hour. We later will speak with the New Orleans Saints beat writer for the Times-Picayune. Greg Easterbrook is writer of the Tuesday Morning Quarterback for Page 2 at ESPN. He is writing a book on football, and he's written a lot of other books. He writes a political column for Reuters, contributing editor for the New Republic, the Atlantic Monthly, and the Washington Washington Monthly. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Thursday, Gilbert King will join us. Fascinating new book, Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and the Dawn of a New America. All right, let's go to phone calls. Our lines are jammed on this issue. Let's start with Jerry in Glendale. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, thanks very much for this very important forum. And I just want to make a comment, then I'll take your guest's response off the air. I think it's important to look at this phenomenon of violence in a broader context of what's happening within the American culture. If you look around, we live in a psychological energy field in which violence is glorified. You can see it in the video games that all the children and adolescents are exposed to. You'll also hear terms about in politics about people trying to destroy the opposition. So I see this phenomenon as not just isolated, but it's really supported by a whole psychological energy field that really puts violence on the high altar.
Greg, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that America is the most football-crazy sport, football meaning the gridiron style of football. In some ways, it does reflect our culture. If you go to France, for example, they love soccer in France. What do they do in France? Fine dining, romance, candlelit dinners. What do we do here in the United States and America? We bomb things. So what kind of game do we want to watch? Football. Now, I also think that football is so popular here because it is the king of sports. It's the best sport. It's the most exciting sport. It's the hardest thing to do. I think only America is big enough and crazy enough to pull off a National Football League or something equivalent to it. But it does in some ways, yes, reflect our culture.
And just to put in a word for baseball, I always heard that hitting a baseball was the hardest thing to do, Greg.
Well, but, you know, think about baseball's place in the evolution of our culture. Baseball was the biggest game in the 19th century and early in the 20th century. Baseball is basically, it's a relaxed sport.
Mm-hmm.
It is difficult to hit a baseball, but there's not that much strategy involved. It's untimed. It's kind of sort of a rural, agrarian feeling sport. It feels like what farm boys would do after they finish their work. They'd get out a bat and ball and just
right
for as long as they want. But you think about how football works. Football is extremely regimented. You must follow instructions, and you really have to. You got to do what the coach says, or the game won't work. There's a clock ticking all the time. It's like an industrial sport. Football, to me, represents the Industrial Revolution and the transition that the country went through.
Bob in Madison, hi.
Well, listen to your guest. It's plain to me he doesn't. He has a very shallow understanding of the sport of baseball. He just really doesn't understand the fine points of what makes baseball baseball. But that's not why I called. I graduated from a Seattle area high school in 1970, and there was a player on the team who was not a friend of mine, but I knew him, you know, reasonably well. He was considered a monster at the time. He was 6'6" and 280 pounds. He was just like looking at a Klingon standing there amidst a bunch of Lilliputians. And one day he hit somebody and killed him on the field.
Oh,
I mean,
my.
This was a playoff game.
Ooh.
And he just killed him. I mean, it was just like right there in the field. They carried him away on a stretcher with a sheet over his face, you know. And he never played another game. In fact, I don't think he was ever, I don't know whatever happened to him, but he was never the same again. And what do they do now? I don't know. I doubt that they'd throw a party, but they would simply see it, I guess, as the hazards of the game or whatever. But it seems to me that at one point, back in the days when Ivy League football mattered, it was much more of a gentleman's game.
All right, let's get a response. Greg?
Well, I don't know the incident that your caller refers to. I can tell you that the last death from an NFL game was in 1966. There have been several deaths in high school football conditioning and high school football games, and one death that I know of in college football conditioning in the last couple of years, the NFL intensely fears that there will be a death on the field. It would be so, I think nobody would clap, nobody would be happy. It would be so deeply shocking that it could lead to Congress, say, regulating football. Now, you know, the total number of deaths in football, you look at it as pretty rare, and there's University of North Carolina has a center that keeps catastrophic sports statistics. The total number of deaths in football is way down than it was in the 1960s because helmets are better now and skull fractures have all been eliminated. But there's still the risk. And if someone were to die in an NFL game or any major college game, I think society would be rightly shocked.
You write in your piece on Tuesday about an incident that people in Wisconsin will be interested in, the Vikings-Saints NFC title game 2 years ago, where you say the Saints' deliberate rule-breaking was worst, and it has to do with Brett Favre.
Well, yes. I wrote at the time after watching that game, that was 2 years ago, I thought, gee, there were a couple of uncalled personal foul penalties that should have been assessed against the Saints. Well, when this all started, I went back and watched that game snap by snap, and I counted four personal fouls that should have been uncalled personal fouls that should have been assessed against the Saints in two plays where the Saints player should have been ejected from the game, and of course that didn't happen either. So I think you go back and look at that game, it doesn't reflect well at all on the NFL.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Mike is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. I mean, now that we know that the Saints have been targeting other players, have the other players brought any litigation against the Saints for being targeted? Does that make sense?
All right, Greg.
Well, that's a big question that's arisen out of this. Steve Young, the Hall of Fame quarterback, has already said he thinks that the people who were injured in Saints games in the last 3 years should sue the Saints. I think the chances of such a lawsuit succeeding are fairly remote. Obviously, especially at the NFL level where you're paid, players know that they are assuming a risk. There isn't anybody who doesn't know that football is dangerous. Should you assume a risk that the other player will actively attempt to injure you? That's not part of the standard rules of the game. To be hit really hard is part of the standards of the game, and courts have generally felt in all sports that when something happens to you that's an anticipated part of the game, that there's no liability even if you're hurt. But if you're deliberately going out of your way to injure someone and you're offering people bonuses for causing injury, I tend to think not, but maybe there's a lawsuit there. And I can tell you that if there is a lawsuit there and anybody wins it, the NFL's in really big trouble.
Let's talk about penalties here. In your piece, you say that Greg Williams and any other coach or team official who abetted this deliberate debasement of the game must be held accountable. How so?
Well, I think penalties should be extremely strict. Coaches talk constantly about accountability. Okay, let's hold these guys accountable. How about Greg Williams is banned from the NFL for 1 year for every 1 year that he ran this system, which is looks like at least 3 years and maybe longer than that. How about the same for Sean Payton, who knew about it and did nothing? That's the head coach of the Saints. And how about the same for Mickey Lewis, their general manager, who knew about it and did nothing? If these guys were athletes, we always come down very hard on athletes for minor violations. If they were athletes breaking the rules of the game in this way, they would be extremely severely sanctioned. Essentially, their management in this situation, they should be severely sanctioned. You can make a case for banning Greg Williams from football for good.
Mm-hmm. Peyton Manning was all over the news yesterday. Somebody has written, and I'm wondering what you know about this, that he was out all last season due to neck injuries that were inflicted because of this kind of very heavy, deliberate hit. What do you know about that?
Well, every NFL defensive coordinator wants to put the other team's quarterback on the ground. You want to do that in college. You want to do that in high school. Youth leagues, you're trying to put the other guy's quarterback on the ground. So it is dangerous to play quarterback, the NFL and NCAA both. And also the National Federation of High Schools that governs most prep play have all strengthened rules in recent years to protect the quarterback, which I think they should, because the quarterback's the player who's most likely to be in a defenseless position. But still, it's dangerous. Yeah, I mean, Steve Young had to leave football because he got how many concussions? Troy Aikman got how many concussions? You stand there in the pocket, you're going to get hit. And you may be legally hit, and you may be hit nice and clean, but it could still do a lot of damage to you.
Yeah. And do you have time for one more call?
Sure.
Well, okay. Let's do that then. Steve is next. Hi, Steve.
Good afternoon. I guess good morning.
Good morning.
I played in a small Wisconsin conference with a lot of small towns, and at 6'3" and 230 pounds, I was probably most often the biggest kid on the field. And my job playing defense was the ball. And one game I had an open field clean shot at a guy, and I hit him hard. And he was taken off in an ambulance, and it had quite an effect on me. But the point was that the coach actually took me out of the game, and I got a royal chewing. And it wasn't a dirty hit. It was a clean hit. But he just said, you know, sometimes you got to learn to pull up. And I went on to college, but I wasn't big enough there, quite frankly, to play the same kind of positions. And I actually know the kid that I hit that hard, and he suffered through quite a bit in high school from the hit. Mm. 30 years later, I suffered myself with I've had several back surgeries from my upper back and my neck from doing exactly that kind of thing. And I guess my point was is that back then, my coach has said, yes, you have an advantage here, but you got to have a sense of responsibility that goes along with that. We want you to knock a guy down. We want you to strip the ball. We want you to have the sacks, but there's also a sense of responsibility that went along with it. And I will have to say, too, that at least on the high school level and probably college level, we're not getting paid a darn thing. And the thing that motivates us is just, I don't know, there's an adrenaline rush you get playing the game that's pretty hard to compare to anything else. It's a double-edged sword. You want to keep it safe, but on the other hand, you want to see hard-hitting quality football. And if you have any comments, I can...
I'm sure he will. Thank you so much for calling, Steve. Greg?
Well, the first thing I say is congratulations to your coach. What a good thing to do. I wish your caller had said the coach's name on the air. Maybe we can get him back.
Do you know his name, Steve? Oh, Steve is gone. Sorry.
Well, maybe you can get him back, because that's the kind of thing that should be, that society should admire. We often tend to exalt the football coaches who want their players to play in a savage way. Not all coaches are like that. A lot of coaches are gentlemen and very sportsmanlike. And the kind of coaches who preach a sportsmanlike version of football are the kinds of coaches, like your caller just mentioned, that everybody should admire. The culture change is needed in football, yet some of it's better. Equipment, for example, the latest iteration of helmet design should reduce concussions and so on. But how the game is coached, how you practice the game, and how officials call the game, that's going to change the culture more than anything else. A proper safe tackling form, for instance. There's a huge emphasis now on teaching safe tackling form. And coaches who tell their players, you know, only hit when it's really necessary, that's the coach that I want to cheer for.
And what would you like to? What kind of investigation needs to be launched, Greg? What do you want answered in the next few months here?
Well, I think the NFL is already on this, and this one you got to admire them because they were out front on this. I'd never heard anything about this until the NFL announced it. So it may have taken them too long to act. If they've known about this for 3 years, why did it take them 3 years to say anything? But at least they have finally acted. I don't think there's any need to investigate football because the things that are wrong with it are obvious to anybody. It's too vicious. There's too much emphasis on money. At the college level, it has a disruptive effect on academics. I think at college, you need to either have a stronger NCAA. The NCAA is a very weak organization. Or the NCAA needs to just be given up on and replaced with some kind of system that will seriously regulate college football. At the pro level, far too much public money goes into the building of stadiums and then ends up in the pockets of owners. I think we need to change the financial structure of public money being converted into private profit in the NFL. And at the high school level, more emphasis on safety, on coach certification. As recently as 5 years ago, most states did not require high school football coaches who have taken a concussion awareness seminar.
Oh, my goodness.
Most states now do. Wisconsin's been one of the leaders in that. A lot of states don't require high school football coaches to know the symptoms of heat stroke. That's got to change. So more emphasis on safety at the high school level would be the third thing that I would hope for.
Yeah, and Steve called back. It was Osseo Fairchild School. The coach's name was Dwayne Marchi.
Well, congratulations to Dwayne Machi, because that is a great story. That's the kind of thing everybody should admire.
Thank you so much for being with us. I hope you'll join us again. We could have you on for all kinds of topics, right? Politics, football, you name it.
You could.
Thank you. Thanks, Greg. Greg Easterbrook, he is writer of the Tuesday Morning Quarterback for Page 2 at ESPN, will reference the piece that he wrote on Tuesday of this week, Saints Scandal Threatens NFL Integrity. It's a good piece, and it looks at how this NFL situation is important because there are so many young people playing this sport, and they take their leadership from the NFL, and this is no kind of leadership to have. So if you're really interested in the topic, go to Greg's piece. We're going to continue. James Varney will be joining us momentarily, New Orleans Saints beat writer for the Times-Picayune. We talked to so many people from the Times-Picayune during the horrible time that New Orleans faced and their recovery, and then they go to the Super Bowl and look what happens. This kind of thing happens, so it's too bad. Too bad for the city, which needed some good news, right? We're going to welcome more phone calls, too. We've been just really jammed with calls, so you will have a chance to get through during our next discussion. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday, Gilbert King will join us, author of Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. It's a fascinating story. It weaves in all of the cases that Thurgood Marshall was dealing with, and he was dealing with Brown v. the Board of Education as this case was going on in Florida. It looks at his life and the stature of the man and how he worked himself. The story is in July 1949, four black men in Florida, the Groveland Four, were accused of raping a white woman, and by the time that Marshall joined the case, one of the defendants who had fled into the swamps had been lawfully killed. Lawfully, in quotation marks. After a trial of the remaining three, two were sentenced to death, one to life imprisonment. Marshall appealed this. It went to the Supreme Court, and they ordered a new trial for the two on death row, though both men were shot while being transported between prisons before the second trial began, and only one survived. It's a fascinating case, as is the life and dedication of Thurgood Marshall, so we will be talking about that hour two of our program. James Varney is with us now, New Orleans Saints beat writer for the Times-Picayune. He's, of course, written extensively about this whole Saints situation, and in a piece, it may be today, said the voices of many who write and comment on the game grew in indignation Monday, 3 days after the NFL said the Saints paid thousands of dollars for cut-off or knockout hits that would sideline an opponent for stretches or an entire game. Prominent national writers calling on the league to lower the boom on the Saints, some calling for dismissal of the Saints general manager and the coach, the two architects of the best teams in franchise history. We'll talk about all of this with James and welcome more phone calls, 800-486-8655. Hi, James.
Hi, well, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks very much for being with us. It is such a sad story to hit New Orleans, isn't it, after all that your city has been through and the great glory of being in the Super Bowl and everybody rooting for you, and now you got this story.
Yeah, I think the initial reaction came along those lines, that what happened in 2009 was such a magical run, and it did so much to kind of lift people's spirits after Katrina. And it seemed to some people in the fan base that this all kind of tarnished a little bit what had happened then, because the most prominent examples that everybody was talking about were plays the Saints had made in the playoff run in 2009. But I don't think that people are still caught on that. I mean, I sense that among the fan base there's sort of, it's kind of shifted to a little more of an angry mood because they feel that the Saints are getting singled out, because there's been a lot of people coming forward to say that this sort of thing, you know, went on with other teams too. It wasn't confined to the Saints.
So what do you think?
You mean, do I think that went on with other teams? I mean, I have to sort of take the players at their word. Now, if you look at what these players, some of whom, almost all of whom actually are former players, and what they've said is that they've drawn a distinction between rewards or financial compensation that was given for high-impact type of plays, like an interception or recovering a fumble or quarterback where you strip him of the ball, and not for anything that was deliberately injurious of an opponent. And they've all been very careful to draw that distinction. So do I think that the first part went on? Yeah, I have no reason not to believe the players when they say that it did. I think the second one there's still some question about, but the league is quite emphatic that it did happen in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Well, there also are teams that are known for being dirty teams, aren't there? All you have to do is, if you watch a lot of football, I would imagine that you would see other teams where this kind of very violent behavior was taking place, that it has to be something that's observable, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that you've got some players, certainly, that have a reputation for maybe being dirty. Obviously, the Steelers have got some players that have been kind of poster boys for that kind of behavior. Ray Lewis, the great middle linebacker for Baltimore, has sometimes been accused of being a vicious player. And on the Saints, certainly last year, you heard other teams leveling that charge against them. Safety Roman Harper was fined for some of the plays that he made in a couple of games. And then, especially the Minnesota Vikings and the Tennessee Titans, there was a game there where there was a couple of ugly plays. So you did hear people talking about what I think were more specific plays and specific players, not so much teams. But the Saints, as a team, I guess, would be the closest to what you were talking about. And again, that's because of what happened in 2009 in those two playoff games in the Superdome.
You talk about the NFL having to come down hard, making a statement here to make sure that the message is clear to current and future players that safety comes first. Does that translate into action? How do they come down hard? What should they do?
Well, I don't really want to say what I think they should do, but I can say that it's clear that player safety has been a buzzword of Commissioner Roger Goodell. There is obviously a whole litigation backdrop that's the major factor here. The league is looking at multiple lawsuits, and they seem to be increasing, filed by former players who say that the league and equipment manufacturers were, you know, they didn't pay enough attention to the long-term effects of injuries and things like this, and they weren't careful. So Goodell obviously looks at this as a test case. And he sort of is going to have to set an example of the Saints. Now, in 2007, when the New England Patriots got in trouble for what everybody called Spygate, where they were illicitly taping Jets coaching signals, there the Patriots got fined $750,000 and stripped of a first-round draft pick. And I think most people see that as the base here, and that Goodell is going to have to do something even more pronounced against New Orleans just to send a message to the league is serious about all this player safety stuff.
Would it be going too far to suggest that certain people will be removed from the game?
I think at this point that might be going too far. Certainly the Saints have been adamant for what's almost a week now that owner Tom Benson's faith in Coach Sean Payton and the general manager Mickey Loomis is unshaken, that they're not going anywhere. Those guys are here to stay. There's been speculation that Greg Williams, who's the former defensive coordinator in New Orleans, who now has the same job with the St. Louis Rams, and he's a guy that when he was a coach at Washington and a coach with the Buffalo Bills, former players on those teams have come forward and said that there was a similar type of arrangement. Again, not to deliberately hurt somebody, but to pay for high-impact plays. But that went on with the Redskins and the Bills. So you got a pattern of behavior there that might be working against Greg, and he could be looking at a possible type of ban like that. But whether or not it would extend to a lifetime ban, you know, like a Pete Rose-type situation with baseball, I think it's too early to say that's going to happen.
I guess I don't understand, James, what the point is in money for deliberately hurting somebody or for high-impact play. What's the point of it? What do you get from it?
Well, I think that these guys are super competitive guys, okay? I mean, they will bet on just about anything, and they bet a lot on college football. Most of these guys come from all the prominent college teams that you've heard about, and it's a big deal every Saturday for them when their teams play each other. They'll bet on throwing empty Gatorade bottles into a wastebasket while sitting in a beanbag.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
I mean, it's part of the nature of the game. And so when you see these type of incentives, it's an internal locker room camaraderie kind of thing, and it gets their competitive juices flowing. It's really not about the money. It's about another thing to spur them to action, I think. And I think that the coaches probably see this as a way to encourage guys and maybe get more high-impact plays. Because, look, those type of plays, interceptions and fumble recoveries, turnovers, you can go through all the statistical gumbo around the game, but turnovers make a huge difference. The team that gets the most almost always wins. So So that's what they're trying to make happen.
But you also, if you're a coach or if you're involved in the game, have to have somewhere in the back of your mind, don't you, the possibility of severe injury, that we've learned so much more about concussions, et cetera, in this game. Aren't you thinking about that?
I think that that's something that is a part of the game, even if this sort of thing didn't go on. Everybody that goes out on the field, if you ever watch it on field level, you'd be astounded by how violent it is. It's terrifying. You don't really get a sense of that if you watch it on TV. So all these guys are going out there. Their career could end on every play. And that's just a part of the game. You guys are going to get hurt. They're going to suffer concussions. They're going to rip a knee up. Whether the other team is trying to do it or not, that just happens. So if you're a coach or if you're a player, you can't allow that kind of thinking to sort of influence your game plan or influence your long-term plans. For example, when you're signing a player to a contract extension, you can't say, well, he might get hurt, so I'm going to maybe diminish his salary a little bit. You got to say, okay, I'm hoping that we get 3 or 4 years or whatever it might be out of this player, his peak performance levels, and I hope that this Sunday we get all these guys playing at their best. I don't think you can allow what you're talking about there with injuries and all the crowd you're thinking.
We go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. James Varney, New Orleans Saints beat writer for the Times-Picayune, is our guest this part of the show. John in La Crosse, hi.
Hi, I just have a question about this. I think it's kind of ironic that we have this conversation at all, because we've created this monster in America with the sports and the way that we handle our sports. We love big hits. We show them on the Jumbotron. They make SportsCenter every night. So these athletes are clearly aware of, I'm going to make the top 10 when this happens. And you hear them talk about it. The other thing, too, is if we were in any other profession where I wanted to get ahead, if I wanted to, you know, get someone out of the game so I could win, you'd get fired. You'd get, you know, you could be sued. You'd be put in jail for some of the stuff that these guys do. You got to take a page from baseball. And I know it's ridiculous that I even say that with the shape that baseball is in, but, you know, you go back to banning people from the game. You know, they commit something like this, and you send a message that says, okay, Harrison, you've lowered your helmet, what, a half a dozen times and taking two guys, you know, out of the games? You can't play the sport anymore. Send a message like that. Hit them not with the money, because you're right. They don't care about money. When I was in high school, we used to talk to each other about who we're going to hit hardest and how we got to hit this kid. You know, that's just what athletes do, but take them out of the game. Don't let them play anymore. Send a message that way, and I promise you that would end a lot of this garbage that would go on.
James?
Well, I think suspensions are clearly looming for players in this one, and I understand John's point that you need to set a couple of serious examples like that before somebody's going to stop and think, you know, this could be the end of my career. You know, we're all waiting to see exactly what players were involved, what exactly they did. The NFL hasn't been all that forthcoming with the evidence in this case. John Vilma, the defensive captain and middle linebacker's name, has been out there for something he allegedly did. Now, the Saints say that Vilma denies doing this, but that he supposedly put $10,000 out for anybody that could take Vikings quarterback Brett Favre out in the NFC Championship. And if that is something that the NFL's got solid evidence on, I think Vilma's looking at a really serious suspension, probably one of the most serious that's ever been handed out to a player, and that's going to cost him a ton of money, and that may be enough of a message. You know, John Sykes Harrison, the Steelers player, multiple suspensions there don't seem to have changed his approach to the game. So you could be right. There's going to have to obviously be, that's what we were talking about a moment ago, more serious penalties than the league has imposed on teams before to try and get people to take this seriously.
An email from Adam. It seems like tackling is a lost art in the NFL. It's more about hitting. I played high school football, and even at that level, it was rare to be told to tackle an opposing player. It was go hit him. It seems that if players would actually tackle rather than turn themselves into a battling ram, some of the horrible injuries might be avoided. If football coaches at all levels agreed to that tackling, could this fix the violence?
I think that there's some truth to that. Obviously, you've heard some people saying that the sort of textbook kind of things that they coach in the early levels when kids start playing football don't seem to carry over all the time to the NFL. But you have to remember the kind of game that the NFL is now, and it is much more of a passing game than a running game. And consequently, you have plays in which the full space of the field is being taken advantage of by the offense, and you have players running much faster and covering much farther distances before they make contact. And that's why you see some of these mammoth hits. You've also got a receiver whose eyes are on the ball as opposed to the defenders that are coming at him. So the type of thing that Adam, I guess his name was, is talking about, I think you still do see that in the running game. It's just that the running game isn't as prominent as it used to be, and as a result, you've got these massive hits going on in the open field at high speed.
Peter in Elm Grove, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to call and talk a little bit about head injuries in football and just injuries in general. I'm actually an emergency physician in Milwaukee, and I see, during high school football season, I see 1 to 2 concussions a week and some pretty horrific injuries from football. And the one thing I've noticed, I mean, I played high school football, and the kids now are just so much bigger, so much faster, so much stronger. They get them into high school, and as soon as they go out for football, they're required to be on the weightlifting team for every year they're going to be on football. And, you know, there's creatine and other supplements, and these kids are just so big. There's a prominent neurosurgeon, and I can't remember his name, who has actually written articles that he feels that the problem with football is actually the helmet, and that he advocates pro football and high school football and all levels getting rid of the helmet. Because if you look at head injuries in Australian rules football and rugby and whatnot, they have virtually none, or it's not a prominent injury. They have much more knee and ankle and elbow injuries and shoulder injuries, but they have little to no head injuries because the players learn to protect themselves. Whereas in football, they're taught to lead with their head.
James. Well, that's an interesting point, and I think there's actually some merit to it. You know, you hear the same thing about boxing with the gloves, and they have these padded gloves, so they're just walloping guys more, and if you went to a bare-knuckle fight, you probably wouldn't see the damage. I don't see that happening. I mean, you're 100% right. My son plays high school football here in Louisiana, and you would think he's playing at Ohio State. I mean, in the summertime, 4 days a week at 6 a.m., they're lifting weights and working out and all. It's incredible. I mean, they're 16, 17 years old doing this. So you're right. These guys are phenomenal athletes, and the force of these blows is really, as I was saying a moment ago, it's kind of hard to believe when you see it. So that is a part of the game. I don't know. I can't imagine the NFL playing without helmet. I just don't see that happening. But that doesn't mean that, you know, guys that are working in emergency rooms don't know what's going on, and that's not a good point.
Have you had these kinds, I'm sure you have, of discussions with your son? Do you worry about him playing football?
Sure. In fact, I picked him up in practice one day last fall, and there was a nurse there telling me that he had had some head-to-head collision with a linebacker and had been seeing stars, so they had taken him out of practice, and they were observing him and everything. And at that time, David Thomas, who's a very good tight end for the New Orleans Saints, his career, well, I shouldn't say that. Let me take that back. His season had just ended because he had suffered his second concussion. And I've been talking to David about this in the locker room. He's got 3 kids. And he was saying, look, you know, it's not like the old days. You hear Peyton Manning, or even now you hear Peyton Manning saying that he deliberately scores low on this test so that if he gets his bell rung, it doesn't look as if he can't go back in the game when they give him that little test on the sideline.
Oh my.
You know, David Thomas said he's got to worry about his family. He's got to worry about his kids. There are long-term repercussions to this. There's some evidence. I don't think they've fully connected the dots that this could lead to ALS, the onset of dementia in later years. I don't think there's any question that taking the smashing hits that these guys do on a repeated basis is good. It has to have long-term health consequences.
Sure. Peter, thanks. We have time for probably one more, maybe 2 calls. Larry in New Berlin. Hi.
Hello. I'm looking forward to meeting you at the domes next month.
Oh, anyway. Great.
Do you think there'll ever be what type of resolution to this concussion situation?
Well, I think that you know, we're seeing the NFL's groping towards that right now, and the flags that they were throwing last year. Jim McKay, who's on the competition committee and the rules committee with the NFL, the big thing that he talked about at the owners' meeting last year was the new rules and how the refereeing teams are supposed to be looking at defenseless players, receivers in the open field. We mentioned a moment ago how their eyes are not on the guy that's coming at them. They're on the ball. They need to have a chance to stop and gather themselves before somebody just tees off on them in the open field. I think there are certain rules and guidelines that can be put in place to put some kind of bubble around the guy, at least momentarily, before you see somebody smashing into them at full speed. And again, with the running back, he's coming at you, you're coming at him, everybody sees what's developing there. You're not running 20 yards before you have the collision. So that part of the game, I think, is already probably okay. What they need to do and what they're striving to do on these concussions is, another good example is on kickoffs and special team plays. They've tried to limit the sort of head speed that players can get on kickoffs. They can't line up as far back as they used to. That slows it down a little bit. They moved the ball back where they kick off, so more kickoffs go out of the end zone, and there's more touchbacks. You don't see as many returns. Those are plays where you've got guys running 50 yards as fast as they can and just slamming into somebody.
Ugh.
So they're curtailing those type of things on which it's most likely for the injuries to occur, and I suspect that kind of theme will continue in the NFL in the next couple.
Thanks, Larry. James, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate your insight. James Verney. Great. New Orleans Saints beat writer for the Times-Picayune. Our conversation, of course, prompted by the New Orleans Saints football team under fire after it was revealed that their players were participating in a bounty program giving cash rewards for injuring other players. I suspect this is just the beginning of this story. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for being at the top of her game and for on-air production as well.